KVC. Shadwell in for Dave Congleton. Well, there we go. Good afternoon. I'm Dan Shadwell.
Yeah, my mic's mixed up.
I was wondering, okay, we're it's going to improve from here on out. I can feel it there, Craig. This is Dan Shadwell in for Dave Congleton on the Hometown Radio Show this afternoon. I'll be with you until 6 o'clock this evening, filling in for Dave while he continues his world travels and stops in all 50 states. More to come about that, I'm sure. Anyway, this afternoon, I wanted to kind of carve up the 2 hours that we have together and talk about a couple of pretty big topics that we've all been hearing a lot about in the news. The first thing is police reform. And you've heard phrases like defunding police. You've heard about retraining. You've probably heard about qualified immunity, specifically with respect to the recent killings of George Floyd and a slew of other unarmed black people around the country. And what I wanted to do with this hour is hear from somebody who I respect, who is a local Central Coast native, and who is now a global consultant for business. He is a management consultant. He's working now as the CEO of a global healthcare company that is headquartered in Houston, Texas. He was also in law enforcement here locally for many years, from 1982 to 1990, and he will tell you that that's a lifetime ago, but he has been paying very close attention to what's been going on here in the last couple of decades since he left police work, and I wanted to bring in Michael Dunn and hear a little bit about his perspective and what he sees as maybe needed reforms, what he thinks will work, maybe what won't work, and just get his take not only from a national perspective, but also, you know, what he's seen here on the Central Coast over the years. Michael, I believe, is on the phone from Houston. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good
nice
afternoon.
Nice to talk to you, Dan.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today. So, all right. So we have so many different aspects that we could discuss here. But right out of the gate, I just wanted to kind of get your take about where we are in this country, in this particular time, because I know policing may seem like a sort of a static type of profession in that it doesn't really change that much, but it has changed, hasn't it?
Law enforcement has changed as society has changed. And you know, when I first started, it was in February of 82, I was all of 18 years old. You know, and in my home county of San Luis Obispo, started San Luis PD. I also worked a brief stint as a reserve deputy sheriff while I worked at San Luis PD. So I've worked at both the sheriff's department and the police department. And I resigned my sworn officer position in April of 1990 with the intent of going to law school and becoming a prosecutor. And I took a sidetrack into business, and I didn't look back.
So, how is do you think law enforcement today different from where the channels, where the emphasis was, maybe where the equipment was? Give me a real quick, if you can, sort of headline description of where policing is now versus where it might have been back in the 80s and 90s.
Yes, so, you know, in the early 80s, in the early portion of the Reagan administration, he cut a lot of social programs to that he felt and his backers felt that were unnecessary. Training programs, one of the major ones that had an effect on society and first responders of all sorts, both the medical and law enforcement, was he quit funding mental health care. And so those people really migrated to the streets. The addiction issues and alcoholism has just been exacerbated since I was an officer. So those two things happened, which, you know, when people don't know how to call, who to call, they call 911, and police officers are the most visible government that you see, that and fire department, whether it's federal or whatever, and postal workers. But when there's a call, if somebody's getting killed, they call the police. If somebody's a victim, they call the police. If somebody's in trouble, they interact with the police if the police are around or they get caught. So nobody really wants to see law enforcement. That's the first change of society is change, and more is expected of police. The second thing I see, and this is more of an opinion, is since the early 90s when I left, the U.S. military started to downsize, and the military gave law enforcement a lot of military weapons and armaments. It also was a response to back in the mid 80s, approaching the 90s, when you went on patrol, especially in large metropolitan areas, gang members and criminals were better armed than the police. I mean, the police until right up toward the 90s were carrying revolvers, and then they started carrying automatics unless you worked for LAPD or something. And then they started to arm the police departments with larger weapons to combat what they were seeing. And in that time, police really became more militarized, and the attitude changed. It's more in big cities, but law enforcement started to shift where we're trying to keep the peace to, okay, we're a paramilitary organization, and they started to act as such because of the way society changed and because of the dictates from the upper echelon of whatever department you worked for. Mm-hmm. Each department has its own culture, per se, but law enforcement as a whole started to make changes due to what was happening on the streets, as they say.
Michael, one of your specialties is branding, and it does seem to me that when you look at police departments around the country, particularly in areas like Minneapolis, where there is long-standing distrust, particularly in minority communities of the police department, that there's a serious branding problem. That it, I'm sure it goes much, much deeper than just the labeling, the branding of it. But when you look at that kind of disconnect, do you see ways from your background in helping people understand a service and what a service can provide based on how it's branded? Do you see a way back to some of these communities having more trust and maybe having an opportunity to kind of reconnect on a different level than just this militarized, polarized, very kind of violent, confrontational history?
I mean, police are the ones that are always called when violence is happening. So they're keyed up and they're trying to protect themselves. When you're in the police academy, you see pictures and hear gruesome stories every day how law enforcement is killed, maimed. I've been shot at. I've been stabbed in the hands and whatnot. I've been bitten. I've been kicked. I've been rolling around with people that were way too big for me. Mm-hmm. So you have to understand that's law enforcement's take whenever they approach a situation. There could be violence happening. And since this has all happened, the citizenry is coming out, and you've seen that they've targeted law enforcement as a respect. Even the people that had the, protect the blue line, which is law enforcement. Well, when they were on the other side, law enforcement's job is to protect at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. Even the people that had those blue flags were hurting the police with them. The police are thrown into violence. That said, branding is about how people behave, and it's an image that you put out. So, police officers brand the community. They brand certain things. But law enforcement brand has been tarnished because of those few bad apples in law enforcement. Every profession has them. But now every citizen in the United States has phones, which cameras and recording devices. That's not necessarily bad per se, but everybody's being recorded. And what law enforcement needs, when I went to UCLA, I took James Q. Wilson's class at Pepperdine, and he was a social scientist that studied law enforcement. He came up with the broken windows concept, where if you live in a crime-ridden area, if there's a broken windows or graffiti, you clean it right up. Law enforcement keeps getting their budgets cut because they are so expensive labor-wise that it takes a lot of police to walk beats and to interact with the community. So law enforcement, in order to keep their budgets, they put one officer per car instead of two. More dangerous in some cities. And they're resource constrained, so they don't have time to make relationships with the community. one way you can rebrand law enforcement is by giving them more bodies on foot patrol where they interact, as they're doing in San Luis Obispo. They're starting to have homeless people that interact. If you maintain relationships with these people, if not trust is built, then you understand each other. In a small town like San Luis Obispo, the police know who the criminals are, and the criminals know who we are, and it's a cat and mouse game. And that if you, say, arrest an addict, a heroin addict or something in San Luis Obispo, and there's a lot of burglaries, burglary rates might drop for a short time up to 10-25% because everybody in the small community knows each other and they know how the game is played. In large communities, it's more systemic that way from crime, and officers don't have time because of resource constraints to make relationships. I think that is another reason that causes this kind of adversarial mindset from law enforcement. Frankly, it took me about 4 years. If I went into if I go into a restaurant or something, I look at all the exits, I keep my back to the door. You look at people differently under that. I can always say, if you walk somewhere, you can always tell a criminal or a cop because they're looking around differently than other people.
Kind of scanning the room all the time. Michael, stay with us here. We want to take a quick commercial break. I'm Dan Shadwell in for Dave Congleton. You're listening to 920 AM, 96.5 FM, KVEC, Hometown Radio. We'll be right back after this break. And welcome back. I'm Dan Shadwell in for Dave Congleton on the Hometown Radio Show this afternoon. I'll be with you until 6 o'clock. We're speaking with Michael Dunn. He is now the CEO of a global healthcare company that's headquartered in Houston. But he is also a San Luis Obispo resident and, in fact, was a police officer here locally from 1982 until 1990. I wanted to pick his brains in part about this whole concept of police reform and maybe kick around some ideas about maybe nationalizing police training, police standards, and get his take on that. And also fold in the fact that his experience in business, I think, is really interesting because he now sees police work from a standpoint of management, branding, all of the sorts of things that company executives are constantly doing as they market products and services to, you know, various markets around the world. Michael, so let's step back here a little bit because I know it's a very, very complicated problem we're trying to kind of get at. Let's back up just a little bit. I know when we see video from around the world, we see different police departments, different police forces managing problems in varying degrees of physical activity, interaction with people that they're arresting and interacting with. How do you, when you look at where we are as a nation, does it seem like a national standard or a national training program, anything along those lines would actually have some real benefit? And if so, how would you go about trying to enact that sort of thing?
Yes, well, I've had a client that does training modules for the Air Force. And the training's extensive because as far as military goes, it's the most technical, and their training for promotion is systemic. In California, Peace Officers and Standards and Training, it's called POST, they have some overall standards, but each academy does things a little bit differently. Each state does things quite differently. If they nationalize police training, you may fall to the lowest common denominator, depending upon budgets and everything. So, you know, if they lowered standards, someone like California would say, well, our standards and you know, are much higher. So there has to be consensus on high standards for those trainings, and yes, it's needed. I think earlier, one of our previous discussions, you know, we've both traveled abroad, and if you go into – England, and I studied at Cambridge for a while. You know, the Bobbies don't have weapons, but since I was there, they've got task forces now that are weaponized because there's more weapons. Then you come back to the United States, and there's more guns in this country than people. And when law enforcement, and this is what I don't understand about many current and ex-law enforcement officers, when we went on a scene, we didn't want people armed because we didn't want to take a life or we didn't want to shoot somebody that was innocent that had a gun. Now, can you imagine rolling up on a scene like that happened in Minnesota with all those armed people? Who are the police supposed to do? They're the targets. But yet you talk to most law enforcement officers and they want, you know, weapons. So it's really difficult. It's a modern day version of many cities across the country, depending upon their gun regulations, are like the OK Corral. And can you imagine having a badge and a unit? You're a target for all kinds of people. Or you might make a mistake, and there might be some, as they say, quote unquote, a good guy with a gun. Well, when you've got a vest on to protect you, and you've got people with heavy weapons, there's no good guys if they're having a gun and you don't know who they are. I mean, that's the dilemma that current law enforcement is thrown into in our society.
So,
and it's not fair to law enforcement, mm-hmm. but yet our citizenry keeps their guns. So it's a very tenuous position and a line that law enforcement has had to learn how to navigate.
So real quickly, that raises an interesting question for me anyway. I always wonder then, why would you have police chiefs, sheriffs, various law enforcement officials basically advocating for people having guns? That it seems like it would make their job much, much more difficult. Is that wrong?
Well, there's two reasons. Number one, it's a political reason. If you tell people, especially San Luis Obispo, if you really think about it, is a beautiful, it's a rural community. You get out of San Luis Obispo, people are rural. Even progressives in San Luis Obispo want their guns, and they carry concealed weapons to protect themselves. If they're a jeweler and they carry cash or whatnot, they don't want to get robbed. So try taking those guns away, you'll be apprehended. So it's both a political means, and in the county of San Luis Obispo, if there were more law enforcement, that would be great. But when I work for the sheriff's department, there might be three units on in the county, one in South County, one along the coast, and one in North County. If you have a shooting, and there was a shooting when I worked on the coastal station with some Hells Angels and some ranchers got in a shooting up near San Simeon, you know, there's one unit to respond to that. So in essence, by the sheriff or a police chief giving, you know, concealed weapon permits, and in California and depending upon the county, they're pretty stringent with the background test. They don't necessarily mind having armed citizenry out there. And if the sheriff tried to revoke those permits, most likely they would be unelected.
Michael, stay with us here. We'll take some calls here after the break. We've got ABC News coming up here shortly, but we're speaking with Michael Dunn. He's a former police officer here in San Luis Obispo. Also spent a bunch of time at the sheriff's office, and also now is the CEO of a global healthcare company. I'm Dan Shadwell in for Dave Congleton. We'll be back right after news with more, and we'll be taking your calls about police reform. What is a good idea? And how do we do it? Welcome back. I'm Dan Shadwell in for Dave Congleton on the Hometown Radio Show. We're talking this hour about police reform, and of course, it's been impossible if you've turned on the news any time in the last, frankly, the last many years, to not see stories about about police shooting, in many cases with deadly result, unarmed black people in particular. But of course, use of force questions are prevalent in every police department around the country, and it's a very complicated problem. But I just wanted to kind of review real quickly. Just since July of 2014, we had Eric Garner, who was killed by police. We had in August of 2014, Michael Brown, who was killed by police. We had in November 2014, Tamir Rice, who was killed by police. We had Walter Scott in 2015. We had Alton Sterling in 2016. We had Philando Castile in 2016. We had Stephon Clark in 2018. We had, of course, Breonna Taylor in 2020. And George Floyd, of course, we have all been watching and hearing about the proceedings in court. And Derek Chauvin, of course, recently convicted of murder in the killing of George Floyd. But then just recently, April 2021, Dante Wright. It's a complicated job. It's a very dangerous job that police officers engage in. And it's a complicated problem that I think certainly doesn't have a solution or two or three or four or five solutions. But that's exactly why I wanted to bring Michael Dunn, who is a retired San Luis Obispo police officer and worked with the sheriff's department here, who's now a CEO of a global healthcare management company. Michael, I wanted to ask you about the concept of fear and how fear plays into this. We have a heavily armed country. The police now have to, in order to be able to combat that, have to be armed. So when we get into situations where things are escalating, the police are ramped up and amped up because they know that their lives could be at risk. They're stopping people who now, I mean, you routinely hear from black people, the moment they see the lights go on behind them, they don't know if they're going to come out of it alive. I mean, it's horrifying and terrifying for them too. How do we walk this back and how does fear get in the way?
I love to address that, and that's an important question. If I can give some personal context to that, you know, my business is about human behavior, and you learn not the theories of human behavior, but as a police officer, if you're effective or a detective, you use human behavior and you learn how to get people to do things they don't want to, like put down the gun, don't kill yourself, tell me that you committed this heinous crime, and if you do, you will go to prison. You know, once I went to school and I started studying, I learned all the theories behind that. Law enforcement has to know that in order to stay alive and to keep people alive. And so I wouldn't say law enforcement, because if you tell a cop that they're afraid, they would say no. But the way the human brain works is, a human brain is supposed to keep us alive. And in law enforcement, like I said, in the training and what they see, if they go into a situation where they're not situationally aware and looking for risks, then they can get killed or they can get hurt or somebody can die. That just has to be the mindset when you go out there. When everybody else is running away, somebody has a gun, somebody's getting killed, horrible things happen, or frankly, I had parents that lived in the wealthy parts of San Luis Obispo, and they called with an emergency. Well, their emergency was their child couldn't clean up their room. But as you're rolling up to an emergency, you don't know that until you get there. So you're ready for a tactical response all the time. If you don't, you know, people can get hurt. That said, society's fearful. You know, I just commuted from California across the country. And I was stopped twice, I'm assuming because with California plates. But I kept my hands on my wheel, my fingers spread open. Yes, sir. Rolled the front. Didn't make any movements. Because I know that that person behind the badge could have a horrible day. They can be upset. And when you're upset and your emotions are high, whether you're a bad guy or a good guy or a cop or a criminal or a victim, you quit using your executive function and your prefrontal cortex. It's an emotional response that resides in the amygdala. When the amygdala happens, police officers, special forces, EMTs, firemen, they resort to their training. And their training, usually in police, is to stay alive. So, hence, they're making a lot of bad decisions. if you really want to help police out, they need higher training, and they need training on how to handle mental health, but not just once a year. They need training. Also, you know, I've seen videos in law enforcement, you know, they're getting fired and they're resigning because they're caught on camera laughing. It's a horrible thing to see, but when you see death on a regular basis, and in a small town you see death, but you know the people, car accidents, suicides, homicides, accidental death, you have to go and maybe report on a friend of yours. It's a difficult task to do, and I think if they really want to help law enforcement, you know, they would give them A, more training, and B, you know, to teach them how to respond other than using gallows humor. And they do it in essence, is a way to get over basically PTSD. Mm-hmm. Is it professional? It sure doesn't look like it, but I understand the human mind and why they do it. It keeps them mm-hmm. normalized.
Mm-hmm. Michael, let's take a call. We got a couple calls on the line. Craig, who's up?
Yeah, we got, first up, we got Eric in San Luis. You're on.
Hi, Eric.
Good afternoon, Dan.
Good afternoon.
Hey, Michael, I have a question for you. We're talking a lot about police reform and focusing specifically on that, but do you feel that police reform needs to go hand in hand with press reform?
Well, actually, Dan and I had this discussion before, you know, Take a look at the press and take a look at social media. The press, most of them are billion-dollar companies. They have learned all along, even before the brain science caught up, that the old adage, if it bleeds, it leads. If it's high emotion, it leads. Watch even KSBY. It's like, and there's something tragic on the fire. Wait till after the commercial break, and we'll tell you. They want you to stay through the commercials. That's how they make money. So is it not happening? Frankly, when I want to reduce stress, I just turn off the news. Here's what's even more insidious, is I know the behavioral economists and social psychologists that help Facebook and Twitter with their algorithms that are getting made, and that's a complete feeling emotion. When you love something and it makes you happy, that emotion takes longer. What emotion locks people in quicker is anger and hate and rage, and that's what and fear. That's what media and plays off of to keep them in. And maybe media doesn't think that deeply about it, but that's in essence what it is. So, you know, I don't know how you can reform the media and free speech, but frankly, the way that they're set up is they keep people keyed up. You're absolutely right. I don't know how to reform that.
Eric, are you what exactly are you asking? Maybe we can define that a little bit more specifically when you say when it has to do with media. Are you saying that the media is somehow creating a more inflamed circumstance? Is that what you're getting at here?
Well, some of the people I've talked to have said that sometimes the media is overly sensationalistic, and at the same time, they lack the ability to report the information in a fair, balanced, and objective manner.
Okay.
Much like you write a report at when you were in college. You look at everything.
There's a little bit of rattling going on in the background there. Eric, so is there a specific incident you're talking about? Because, I understand what you're saying, I think, and probably everybody understands it. Yeah, certainly media, just by covering something, can inflame the circumstance. Absolutely.
Yeah, if we're looking at reform, I guess what I'm asking is, would it be wise of us to also have reform with the press at the same time as police reform?
Okay, interesting question. I don't know really how to answer that. It's a pretty broad question, but let's go to the next caller here, Craig. Yep.
All right, next up we got Joseph Oceano. You're on.
Hey, Joseph.
Hello. I want to make a comment. I believe that reforming the police was already tried multiple times throughout many decades, and it doesn't work, because what reform means is just giving more money to police departments whose trainers, let's be clear that Chauvin was the supervisor on scene mm-hmm. who killed George Floyd.
Right.
Porter, the lady mm-hmm. who killed another, she was a trainer. Mm-hmm. So you see, from my perspective and from my lifetime and from my point of view, and not just my point of view, but many people, brown people and black people, know for a fact that police get trained to kill, to shoot first. You know, and that puts our lives in danger, the citizens, and not just, you know, it puts mostly, as you started this segment, we all hear the news. You can't deny the video evidence. You can't deny all these stories of all these people getting killed unarmed while holding the wheel, getting shot in the back of the head. A 16-year-old getting shot, and then people saying, oh, that's a hero. When is a hero? How is a hero a person who kills a 16-year-old girl?
Joseph, you know? So Joseph, what if police reform is not if that's not going to do it, what would do it? What's your thought?
So what would do it, and it's a really controversial, especially I'm sure for your listening audience, but I'm an abolitionist. I believe that the police system was made to put black and brown people inside jails, prisons. And that's what's going on. The prison system needs to be abolished because all it does is throw people in there which have either mental or drug problems. They need help. They don't need to be locked up in a cage for 5 years for all their life. But what it is, it's control. It's power. The government. The police are used as an arm of the government to control the masses. When black people are justified in their rage and in their anger, what do police do? All of a sudden you get Blue Lives Matter to counter Black Lives Matter? Come on. Yeah. What does that tell you about the police force in general?
Joseph, let me get Michael's thoughts about that. Michael, you want to respond from perspective maybe of, you know, an ex police officer, or what are your thoughts?
Absolutely. I understand Joseph's feeling. But his solution is aimed at the wrong thing and is too severe. No, police aren't taught to keep black and brown people down. I think that that's depending upon the race of the police officer, that depends on their mindset. If you try to abolish and defund the police, the people in the poorer communities where crime is rampant will not have it. They need the police out there. Police are not trained to kill, but let me finish, please. Police aren't trained to kill, but they are, because if you deconstruct most police shootings, people, you know, they don't shoot on the range. They're taught to shoot center mass. Well, center mass, of course, if they hit it, people will die. It's pretty archaic, frankly, that they're using the same weapons that they used with maybe a little improvements to defend themselves and to stop crime as they did back in the 1800s. I agree that we put too many people in prison in the United States, and especially in California, for drug crimes and mental health issues. That's not a police reform issue. That's a prison and societal reform issue. And if you ask the legislatures in your state, and they have to remove budget from teaching or something like that, they just won't happen. So it's easy to blame everything on law enforcement for people that are trying to keep the peace. All of those crimes that you said are committed, they're horrific. Those officers should be called an account. Unfortunately, the way the system is set up legislatively is, how are they called to account, the cities? Through civil lawsuits when they find out this case. Is it broken? Absolutely. But police reform needs to happen. It's needed to happen for a long time, and they can't, as a profession and as a needed first responding profession, they can't all be blamed, and you cannot abolish them. Society wouldn't operate without somebody coming in when society was out of control.
We need to.
And there also needs to be diversity training, and like I said, to teach police officers how to handle different communities. They're not funded. They're not trained that way.
Yeah. We're going to try to squeeze in a break here, but to Joseph's point, you know, in many parts of the country, law enforcement did originate through the efforts to try to return black people to slavery. So there is something. So there, this is part of why this is so complicated. I'm Dan Shadwell. We're working here through the Hometown Radio Hour here for the next. We got about 10 minutes. We're going to squeeze in a break. We'll be right back with more calls. Stay with us.
I go out by myself, and I look across the water, and I think of all the things.
And welcome back. I'm Dan Shadwell in for Dave Congleton on the Hometown Radio Show. We are blazing through this hour. We've been speaking with Michael Dunn. He is the CEO of a global healthcare company, but also has vast experience in branding and management, but also was a local police officer. And I wanted to pick his brains here during this hour about some of the concepts that we've been hearing about in the news, police reform, qualified immunity, some of the various ideas that that are up for discussion. We have Jeff from San Luis Obispo. I want to, Jeff, if we can keep it quick here, because I want to get your question in here, but then give Michael plenty of time. And I've got a little bit of I've got a couple questions myself. So Jeff, go ahead. What's your question?
Hi, how are you folks today?
Doing well.
Mike, you said a statement a little earlier that I think is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. It is not, you know, most of our policemen here in San Luis Obispo, for sure, are really good policemen. Mm-hmm. It's a handful that spoil it for the rest. And what the problem is, it's the same officers that habitually do bad acting. Mm-hmm. And when they go through court and they're under oath, and they perjure themselves under oath, nothing is ever done to these folks. The very worst thing is they kind of say, oh, well, okay, this particular case, we'll go ahead and dismiss it because the policeman lied. But they keep that policeman there, and this is a problem. Mm-hmm. And we need more transparency. Weed out the bad so we have nothing but good, or a lot of good, more good. Let's say that. What's your thoughts here,
Michael?
I think you're absolutely right. It's usually a small individual or individuals, depending upon the size of the department or a group of people, that are bad actors, and the culture in the department gets swayed, and it loses track, and they really think. I mean, I've heard law enforcement, and I was on a like ex law enforcement blog, and they've been watching too many American snipers. They want to go get some, and they're sheepdogs. You know, it's like, okay, that's just it's the wrong mindset. But what it means is a management issue. Mm-hmm. You know, managers and police chiefs and line people need to control those people. Here's the hard part. It's really hard to control those people when you don't have enough staffing. Mm-hmm. Your staffing is an issue. If anyone is ever caught during perjury, that A is a crime, and B, it's against every police department standard operating procedures that are in there. Those people will and should be fired. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of civil servants, police officers, fire officers, teachers have, and California correction officers have unions. They have strong unions to protect police officers' rights so that they don't get railroaded, so that they get a free trial and that they experience due process. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, most of the, you know, when George Floyd was killed, the city of Minneapolis is going to have to pay millions of dollars. Will that change things? It should, but they should change it at a national level and increase standards. But that has a high cost to it. And try to get legislators. They'll be on the stump, especially the Republicans. They'll be on the stump, and they'll be saying, you know, we're law and order. But they don't fund it. They don't fund societal issues that cause a lot of these issues. And the Democrats, they throw a lot of money in, but you know, the issues that are causing these problems are systemic and they're societal. And here's what people have to remember. Even Joseph said, I understand why he feels like he does, because he watches the media and he sees the horrific action. But there's thousands of calls police officers go on day to day that go smoothly. Mm-hmm. I'll probably get in trouble from Ian Parkinson and the chiefs of police on the Central Coast. But once COVID minimizes, if you really think that happens, go with an open mind and ask to go for a ride along, just for one shift in a quiet town where not a lot of shootings happen. But in our county, 3 active shooters happened in the county just this last year. Go see what those people deal with, and you might have a different mindset before you judge something. Like any researcher, see what it's like to go in when everybody else is running. They by duty have to run in. They can't walk away from a fight if someone's hurting citizens. They have to run in. Hence, mistakes are made, and of course, people's amygdalas are keyed up, and you see these atrocious mistakes. If you take a life and you have a soul, and I don't know about Derek Chauvin because he sure didn't look like it, it's going to ruin those people for a long time. A lot of law enforcement officers, when they have to take a life, they resign. That one woman that killed that person, and I just, people go, how did she, you know, she lose her taser from her gun? Emotions were high, she obviously thought, and she absolutely killed him, and should never have happened. She resigned. It's a very difficult position to be in. Of course, that family will get a massive civil suit, rightly so, for a life that was taken too early. It's a tragedy, but what it needs is more training, more situational training, and all of that has a price tag.
Jeff,
and unless we hold our legislators accountable, they won't fund it.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Michael, real quickly, I want you to address, because we've been talking about, you know, the few bad apples. We hear this phrase, a few bad apples, a lot. But is there a structural problem? And we've just got about a minute left here, by the way, so I'm sorry for that. But is there a structural problem in the way police departments are set up? I mean, we saw these officers standing by while George Floyd was basically being killed and watched their own supervisor, and none of them intervened. Is there a structural problem in the way police departments are set up that encourages that kind of bad behavior or a lack of willingness to intervene?
I don't think it's structural, and the intervening, it's much like a military. Police are a paramilitary organization, and so they report up the line. So there's some trepidation when you have to go against your boss and tell your boss. I mean, some incidents happened in San Luis Obispo County that I was aware of, and even when I was a police officer, and police officers have this strange mindset, because when you have a gun and a badge on, it really is.
Yeah. Michael, we're going to
against the community.
We're going to have to leave it there. Michael Dunn, thanks so much for your time this afternoon. I'm Dan Shadwell in for Dave Congleton. We'll pick up right after the top of the hour and news.